I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny. This week, military historian Anthony Beaver talks about Hitler's last gamble in Ardennes 1944. Anthony Beaver is the author of Crete, The Battle and the Resistance, Stalingrad, Berlin, The Downfall, The Battle for Spain, D-Day, The Battle for Normandy, and the Second World War, amongst others. His books have appeared in 30 languages and have sold more than 6 million copies. A former chairman of the Society of Authors, he has received honorary doctorates from the Universities of Kent, Bath and East Anglia, and is a visiting professor at the University of Kent. In the United States, he received the 2014 Pritzker Literature Award for Lifetime Achievement in Military Writing. And Anthony's latest book is Ardennes 1944, Hitler's Last Gamble, which is what we're going to be talking about today. So, Anthony, thank you very much for joining me on Little Atoms.
Good to be here, Neil.
This is a fantastic read. You go through this campaign pretty much day by day, and I mean, I guess we're going to talk all the way through the campaign. There's a lot to cram in. Spoiler alert, we're probably going to give away what happens at the end. But before we start, actually, on the Ardennes, going back to the subject of one of your previous books about D-Day, the invasion of France has happened, but it's a long way to Berlin, the subject of another one of your books. So let's talk about what happens to the Allied offensive once they're in France.
The fighting in Normandy was far tougher than anybody had expected. They'd assumed that about 10,000 people would be killed on D-Day and drowned. But in fact, the casualties were far lighter, despite Saving Private Ryan and Omaha Beach and all that sort of business. In fact, let's forget that as many French civilians were killed on D-Day as Allied soldiers. And in the fighting in Normandy, where the Allies, of course, tended to rely on their advantages, which tended to be air power and artillery, not surprisingly, a lot more French civilians died. In fact, it's one of the great ironies that democracies at war tend to kill more civilians simply because to reduce their own casualties because of pressure at home from parliament, press, public opinion, they will rely that much more on high explosives. And that is why, in fact, more French were killed by the British and the Americans in the Second World War than British killed by the Luftwaffe. And I think that when I found that when doing the research, I must say it was quite a shock. But it did bring out this terrible contradiction about democracies at war. Anyway, the fighting in Normandy was far worse than expected, particularly for the Americans in the Bocage, and the British and Canadians who found themselves fighting the elite of the SS Panzer divisions brought back really from the Soviet Eastern Front. And finally, though, in July, end of July, the Americans achieved the breakthrough on the west. Montgomery had always refused to acknowledge the possibility that the Germans actually were going to concentrate the bulk of their forces against the British on the left, on the eastern side, because if they broke through, it would have trapped all the Germans further over towards the Atlantic. And that's why the British and the Canadians had such a tough time. Anyway, the Americans broke through, and then suddenly Patton had his glorious dash for the Seine with his Third Army, which had just been brought into existence. And the German collapse in France was very rapid. So what you saw was that Normandy had become, in many ways, the sort of the sacrifice for the whole of France. Mm-hmm. The rest of France was hardly touched by destruction, thank God. But Normandy suffered very, very badly indeed. And that dash to the Seine, of course, caught the Germans out. It triggered this huge retreat right the way across France. It wasn't just German forces on the Atlantic and the Mediterranean coast who had to start pulling back rapidly towards either Dijon, which was where they had a sort of holding area, or even towards the German frontier.
And of course, the advance happens quite quickly. There are big sort of, you know, marquee victories like the liberation of Paris and stuff. But the quicker an advance is, obviously that presents problems, doesn't it?
It certainly presented problems in logistic terms, mm-hmm. because with the supplies coming in through Cherbourg, which had the port, which had been heavily mined by the Germans and had only just started to be cleared. Otherwise, they were coming in over the beach at Omaha, the Americans and the British on the Mulberry and Aramanche. And so from that point of view, the advance then suddenly turned out to be far quicker than anybody had expected, which was using up vast amounts of fuel and gasoline for the American armour divisions, which were using thousands of tonnes of gasoline per day.
More fuel than they were delivering.
Actually. More fuel than they were delivering, even with the idea of the pipeline under the ocean Pluto, mm-hmm. of the oil being delivered in that particular way. It got there. It was a question of how you got it to the front. And mm-hmm. this is when they started developing what was called the Red Ball Express, where these poor African-American drivers were sort of literally being forced to drive not just through the night, but day and night to the point of total exhaustion, and many were killed in accidents. But that was the need at the time. So the whole question was, eyes were on Antwerp, and the capture of Antwerp was vital. But in the dash after the liberation of Paris, the sort of dash towards the German frontier and into the Low Countries, exhilaration, shall we say, victory euphoria, mm-hmm. took hold. And Montgomery particularly, who already was creating tensions with the Americans by his demands as to become the land forces commander, and therefore to have the bulk of the supplies, because Montgomery sort of said, I should be the one, you know, to charge through. Now, he was right in a way, because there were the V2 sites, and they knew that those were about to be used in Holland, and they knew that Antwerp had to be captured and so forth. But Montgomery was seduced by the attractions of an airborne operation using what was called the First Allied Airborne Army to get across the Rhine, because he felt if he was the first to cross the Rhine, then Eisenhower would have to give in the bulk of the troops and the bulk of the supplies.
Now, I'm of an age where I grew up hearing, you know, stories about Montgomery, about the battles in the desert and, yeah. and Europe. He's one of the, you know, the great heroes of the British Second World War campaign. He doesn't come across very well in this book.
Well, the trouble with Montgomery was he did a vital service, if you like, in North Africa. He was very good at training troops. He was very good at sort of instilling morale and so forth. But in fact, in actually in North Africa, most of the reforms that were necessary had already been carried out by Auchinleck. But Auchinleck had lost Churchill's confidence, and so Montgomery was put in. But Montgomery was a very cautious general, partly for good reasons, because in the First World War he'd been horrified by the slaughter and he didn't want to waste lives. But on the other hand, there were other commanders who said actually he, in the longer term he may have lost more lives by caution. Patton especially criticised Montgomery in that particular way. But it's always one of the great quandaries, if you like, of military leadership and command, of whether if you take a risk you're going to lose more lives or actually save lives. And Patton often felt that it was the pussyfooting around of Allied generals which actually caused so many lives. And he may have been right in Normandy. And of course, when he had his breakthrough, he lost very few casualties. It's mm-hmm. certainly true. But everything was going his way at that particular point. But then Patton himself, when he came up against Metz, he lost a lot of men. Mm-hmm. His Third Army got a very bloody nose. And we'll come on to it later in the what happened in the Ardennes. So it's one of the great debates, if you like, about sort of, you know, military command and military strategy of, you know, do you take the risk and the risk of the lives of men? But certainly in the fighting in the Bocage, the German generals criticised the Americans for sort of constantly mounting single battalion attacks, which they said was brilliant for training their new troops because they could deal with it, there wouldn't be a breakthrough and all the rest of it. And actually they were able to inflict horrendous casualties on the Americans in these small attacks. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you know, the terrain was not good for launching with all of those hedgerows and all the rest of it, dense hedgerows and little tracks. The terrain was not good for launching a big sort of punchy attack of the sort that Patton wanted.
I'm Natalie Haynes. You're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
So also what's going on while this advance is going on, and you've mentioned Antwerp as being the sort of the key target, another port that would be much further up the country to enable resupply. All of these, there's a whole list of places that begin with an A, not least the Ardennes, but Aachen and Arnhem, which are going to come into this story shortly. And as the Allied forces are heading to those places, there's politics going on, and again, Montgomery is playing a rather key part in that.
Well, on the 1st of September, the announcement was made that General Omar Bradley, who'd been commanding the 1st US Army, was now going to command the 12th Army Group, which therefore meant that he was no longer under Montgomery's command. I mean, that had been fairly notional during the fighting in Normandy. And it meant, basically, that Montgomery was now an Army Group commander, the 21st Army Group, equal with Bradley. The British press behaved ridiculously and very stupidly by saying our national hero has been insulted, etc., etc. And Churchill felt obliged to promote Montgomery to Field Marshal, which is basically a 5-star appointment. Mm-hmm. Now, Eisenhower was only a 4-star general, and Bradley was only a 3-star general. So, I mean, from the Americans' point of view, I mean, this was pretty irritating, mm-hmm. and you've only got to read Patton's diary about sort of, you know, how sick they were to hear the Field Marshal and all the rest of it. Monty's ego was extraordinary, and as a character, it's rather difficult to understand how he could have made some of the really preposterous remarks that he used to make in terms of his self-regard. And, when he went to Buckingham Palace, he said to the King's private secretary, Lascelles, he said, showing his berry, he said, you know, this hat is worth 3 divisions. My men see it from afar and they say, there's Monty, and they're ready to fight anybody. Nobody with an ounce of self-knowledge would ever come up with sort of, you know, remarks like that. And I, therefore, in this book, rather perhaps controversially, sort of suggest the possibility that Montgomery suffered from, or in fact had, high-functioning Asperger's. Mm-hmm. And it's quite interesting, actually. You sometimes think that this is sort of rather new and shocking. And of course, you find that, in fact, you've reinvented the wheel. Somebody then passed me a paper written by a psychiatrist, professor of psychiatry at Trinity College Dublin, who'd gone into this in the early 1980s about Montgomery and high-functioning Asperger's or whatever. So I certainly wasn't the first there. But others, and certainly Montgomery supporters, were sort of rather horrified by this and didn't want to accept it at all. But of course, you can't know for sure. You can't sort of analyse or diagnose somebody long after their death anyway. And of course, in Montgomery's day, nobody had even heard of it. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's only one of the ways that Montgomery was... it was only one of the ways that one can explain how Montgomery behaved in such a totally thoughtless way with the Americans, mm-hmm. Not realising what the disastrous effects of his behaviour would cause.
And that whole, I mean, the battle that would eventually lead to the Canadians, I seem to recall, taking Antwerp, but the battle, part of that, Operation Market Garden, the battle for Arnhem, which again was Monty's doing. There was a lot of almost pointless failure going on.
Well, the trouble was the failures came mainly because British, American and Canadian generals all thought that this was August 1918 and that the German army was collapsing as it had collapsed in August 1918. Everybody started to think that the war was going to be over by Christmas, quite literally. In America, they even started cancelling contracts for artillery shells. Mm. And the British government, the only person actually who was right to be suspicious that this was not going to be the case, of course, was Churchill, who was very, very dubious. But even so, the war cabinet basically took the end of the year for planning purposes as being the end of the war. So everybody made that particular mistake. It wasn't just Montgomery. And it wasn't just Montgomery who was responsible alone for the failure to capture, not Antwerp itself, but the approaches to Antwerp. Mm-hmm. What had happened was, on the 4th of September, the 11th Armoured Division had actually seized Antwerp, helped by the resistance, and the Germans were totally taken by surprise. The trouble was that they didn't then do anything to clear the Scheldt estuary, mm-hmm. because, you know, the port, even though it's captured intact, was no good if you couldn't control the estuary. And the trouble was that the German 15th Army, which had been retreating from the Pas-de-Calais, were commanded by General von Zangen, was very, very effectively brought back and then kept a pocket on the south side of the Scheldt estuary. Babotskan's pocket, and then also held the whole of the peninsula to the north. And the Navy, Admiral Ramsay, Admiral Cunningham, and all the rest of it, had warned Chafe, had warned Eisenhower, and they warned Montgomery, you know, that this would be disastrous. As Cunningham said, you know, it was as much use to us as Timbuktu if you didn't have the approaches to the Scheldt. And anyway, that was one sort of disaster there. And Montgomery, although he was desperate egotistical reasons to be the first across the Rhine and therefore embraced the idea of Operation Market Garden, he was also supported in this by Eisenhower, but especially in Washington by General Marshall and above all, of course, by General Arnold, who commanded the US Air Force, because they had at huge expense created this first Allied Airborne Army, which had the two American airborne divisions, the 101st and the 82nd, the British airborne divisions, the 6th and the 1st, and also the Polish airborne brigade. And they wanted to use it, and one plan after another to use it in the advance from Normandy had been basically scrapped because the troops on the ground were advancing far faster, and every single time these poor paratroopers were ready to jump almost and lined up at the airfield, and suddenly the order came through cancelling at the last minute because the advancing troops already reached the target area, so they weren't needed anymore. So this is why there was this compulsion to use it. But the trouble was, it was a disastrous plan, both in terms of, I mean, it was really an object lesson in how not to plan an operation. And the idea that, you know, by seizing all the bridges on the way to Arnhem meant that you could roll out this carpet, as they called it, underestimated two things. In fact, it totally ignored two things. One is the old saying that no plan survives contact with the enemy. And the other was, of course, that the Germans were brilliant at recovering from disaster. And they ignored both of those. And actually, the plan never deserved to work, unfortunately. And it was not just a heroic disaster. It actually was a predictable disaster which should never have been taken on.
So let's go on to the German side then. So what becomes, from the German side, the Operation Watch on the Rhine? Let's talk about why Hitler eventually decided on the Ardennes, on that strategy.
Hitler's obsession at this particular stage was of trying to hit back. He'd tried it in Normandy with the offensive towards Avranches, and that had failed. He'd been warned. I mean, it was too little too late. The idea was to sort of cut off Patton's Third Army charging towards Paris. But, you know, they simply didn't have the forces. Even if they managed to break through, they wouldn't have had the forces to hold open the corridor. But Hitler was determined to do it again. And he, in the early part of September, he actually was suffering badly from jaundice and was in bed in the Wolfschanze in East Prussia. And he started having these sort of mad fantasies. And by then, of course, the German troops had withdrawn to basically a line from Holland down along the German frontier. And he, which was basically the West Wall, or the Siegfried Line, as the British and the Americans called it. And he then had this fantasy that if they attacked through the Ardennes, which was weakly held at that particular point by the Americans, and swept through from the Eifel into the Ardennes, all forested area, which he thought could conceal them from air reconnaissance, cross the River Meuse, and then swing north towards Brussels and Antwerp, he would cut off the British and the Canadians and force them into a Dunkirk-type evacuation. Mm-hmm. Now, this was a fantasy. I mean, it was one of his worst map fantasies, in a way. The trouble was, of course, that what he was looking at was war on three fronts at that particular stage. The Italian front. Now, if he launched a counteroffensive in Italy, that would have made no difference, even if he'd pushed them back from 100 miles or something like that. If he'd launched it on the Eastern Front against the Red Army, that would have been eventually smothered by the vast manpower superiority of the Red Army. But on the Western Front, he felt that this, again, other fantasy of his, that the Allied coalition was very fragile and would break apart, and that if he could knock, say, even just the Canadians out of the war, but even perhaps the Canadians and the British, who he felt were war-weary, then he might come to a deal with the Americans and then concentrate all of his forces on the Eastern Front. Now, none of his generals believed this. They were absolutely appalled. And on the 16th of September, which actually was the day before the paratroop drops on Arnhem, Nijmegen and Eindhoven. Hitler announced it at his Lagerbesprechung, his sort of situation conference. And there was absolute horror, particularly from General Guderian, who was in command and responsible for the Eastern Front, because he knew perfectly well that if all of these forces were concentrated, and that would weaken the Eastern Front, and were then involved in this counterattack in the West, it wouldn't be that long before the ground froze hard and Stalin would launch his winter offensive.
This is Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Anthony Beaver and we're talking about his book, Ardennes 1944, Hitler's Last Gamble. And so, Anthony, I want to talk about why the Ardennes, really. Now, the Germans had advanced into France through there before, so they knew that was obviously a possibility. But you've mentioned the terrain, so I want to talk about the terrain, and it's obviously getting towards the winter as well, so it's going to be, you know, the weather's going to be bad. And I guess to look into this, let's take a step back before the Ardennes campaign and around the fight for Aachen. There's a forest, the Hergen Forest.
The idea of coming through the Ardennes anyway was something which certainly should have registered, shall we say, with the Allies, because not only had the Germans done it in 1940, but they'd also done it in 1870 and in 1914, as well as in 1940. So the idea that it wasn't going to be an active front was a very, very unwise assumption on the part of General Bradley, but we'll be coming back to that later. The reason why the Germans defended the Hürtgen Forest, which is just to the north of the sector where Hitler was planning to launch his great Ardennes offensive, was simply because they had to make sure that they could secure that particular flank of the forthcoming operation. Now, it had been chosen by General Hodges and supported by General Bradley as the area for advancing to the River Ruhr and then on to the River Rhine, partly because on the map it didn't look quite so far. But in fact, it was a formidable, it was appalling terrain in terms of dense pine woods, deep ravines. There was a certain amount of mixture of a little bit of pasture and beech and oak on the broad ridges. But for American advantages in air power and in tanks, the Hürtgen Forest couldn't have been a worse place to pick. And the men going in there, the silence of the forest, I mean, the only sound was sort of the wind in the trees and perhaps the mew of buzzards before the sounds of war wrecked all of that. They found it deeply spooky, and it certainly contributed, I think, to the very high rate of psychological casualty which American and, to a certain degree, the Germans were going to suffer, but much more the Americans. Anyway, the idea was that they would sort of punch their way through, but I mean, the whole plan was so badly thought out. I mean, General Hodges basically was expecting one division. In fact, he then split it up and had only about one infantry regiment basically attacking into this forest. Well, considering the forces that he had at his disposal, this was absolutely mad, but it woke up the Germans to the threat in this particular region, and so they started reinforcing it massively.
There's this incredible scene once the fighting starts of the shells bursting higher than normal, like in the, on the tree line.
Well, Hemingway does describe the fighting there as Passchendaele with tree bursts. It was mud, smashed trees in all directions. And the point of the tree burst, of course, was that it was rather like fighting in sort of ships of the line in the 18th century, because the flying splinters of wood caused as many casualties as the shrapnel. I mean, this is one of the reasons why the fighting was so terrific and horrible. It was also very savage indeed. I mean, I think one of the most horrifying examples I came across was of a badly wounded American soldier who was found by three German soldiers, and they put an explosive charge under him so that he couldn't move. Which is booby-trapped, and then left him, having stripped him of all of his possessions. And this poor wounded man had to try and stay awake for 72 hours to warn the people who found him or rescued him, eventually, of the booby-trap, because, you know, not just he would be blown up, but they'd be blown up with it.
Hitler obviously wanted to keep the idea for this offensive top secret, and to a certain extent did. But more specifically, it did come as a surprise to the Allied forces that this happened. What did the Germans do to keep it a secret until the last minute?
Well, Hitler allowed only a very few numbers of senior officers in for the briefing to begin with, only chiefs of staff of armies and so forth. And then it was only briefed down to sort of core level, immediately underneath, and everybody had to sign a piece of paper saying that they would, they knew that they would be shot if they revealed any information about it. And yet, the astonishing thing which I found in the British archives here in Kew was that in the files of SESDIC, which were the Combined Services Detailed Interrogation Centre, the German Jews who were listening into the conversations of German generals who'd been taken prisoner found that they knew all about it. And yet, when this was reported up the line, nobody took it seriously. Here were German generals talking about this huge offensive which was being prepared in their prison camp. And this was reported to the War Office and to Schaeff. And nobody reacted because they simply couldn't believe that the Germans were capable of getting together a counterattack force of that size.
So let's talk about the first few days of the offensive. How does it go for the Germans?
Well, the Germans did achieve that surprise, and this was because of the intelligence failure on the Allies side. It actually shows one of the key lessons, if you like, of intelligence, if you like, and that is there's no point just putting yourself in the boots of your opponent, because you're putting yourself in the boots of your opponent but with your own mentality and your own thought processes. You want to understand his thought processes. And they assumed that General Feldmarschall von Rundstedt, who was the commander-in-chief West, was the one who was organising the offensive, and they used to call it Rundstedt's offensive for a very long time. Rundstedt was furious when he heard about this. He said, because he had rejected it entirely as a very, very bad idea. But it does show this thing. What they should have done was to put themselves into the mind of Adolf Hitler rather than into, as I say, positioning themselves from Rundstedt's point of view. Because dictators don't think in the same way as generals, and there's always going to be a touch of megalomania. And we found this also with the intelligence failure over Saddam Hussein and over Iraq. Anyway, they made that major problem, and they simply could not believe that the Germans could get together a sufficient force of that particular size, and they could not imagine them coming out of the Ardennes, because they had believed that all of their information, basically the golden goose, if you like, was Ultra at Bletchley Park, and Ultra picked up nothing. Now, if you're going to have complete radio silence amongst German formations preparing for an attack, obviously Bletchley was not going to pick up anything, and they made that fatal assumption too. So anyway, the Allies were completely caught out, and so when the Germans launched their attack on the morning of the 16th of December, early at about 4 o'clock, the Americans couldn't really believe what was happening. And they had in the north, on the northern part of the sector, there was Sepp Dietrich's 6th Panzer Army, which included most of the SS Panzer divisions. And then further to the south, there was General von Manteuffel's 5th Panzer Army. And then further down, there was the 7th Infantry Army, basically, which was just going to protect the flank. And the two Panzer Armies were to charge ahead, cross the Meuse, and then swing north. And the 6th Panzer Army was the one that was really expected to achieve the breakthrough. Now, the American reaction on the whole was one of total confusion, refusal to understand what was happening. And General Bradley, in fact, on that particular day, had left to go to Versailles to see Eisenhower. And it was the morning that Eisenhower heard that he was to get his fifth star. So finally he was back on the same level as Field Marshal Montgomery. And they chatted away, and then suddenly news came in of a German offensive. And Eisenhower, to his credit, sensed that this was big. Bradley refused to believe it. Partly also, one thinks, because Bradley had underestimated the potential of an enemy attack. And he'd only left four very weak divisions in the Ardennes, and he failed to accept that he had actually made a major mistake in that particular sense. He could not believe that the Germans could get together an offensive of that particular size. So,
hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
There was a certain amount of chaos, but at the same time, the whole German programme depended on the shock and awe of brutality. Mm-hmm. 4 days before the attack on the 12th of December, Hitler had summoned all of his divisional commanders and the army commanders to the Adlerhorst, his sort of headquarters in the West, and lectured them on the need for brutality, cruelty, and so forth, basically to shock the Americans into collapse. He felt that this was sort of the tactic. Now, as we found and saw, both in the Sino-Japanese War and in the invasion of the Soviet Union, actually the shock and awe of cruelty does not automatically create total collapse. It can also provoke the most desperate resistance. And this is also what happened in the Ardennes, because there were, although many American troops, particularly the sort of replacements and the green troops, who had no idea what was going on, often surrendered or ran for it, there were groups who actually fought back with tremendous bravery at particular points of crossroads and key villages. And this fatally broke the program or the momentum of attack of the German forces. And so they did not achieve, if you like, that critical mass and critical speed necessary for a breakthrough.
I'm Jonathan Meads, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Well, I want to talk about one of the sort of key figures of the offensive then now that absolutely symbolises Hitler's, you know, idea of the sort of the brutality and the shock and awe, and that's Piper.
Jochen Piper.
Who's, I mean, he's like almost a sort of moustache-twirling Nazi from Central Casting. He's such a, you know, a true believer.
Well, he was very much a sort of the good-looking beau ideal of an SS officer. You know, clean-shaven, black hair, slicked black, and all the rest of it. But, I mean, in Russia, on the Eastern Front, he was famous for his brutality. In fact, his particular unit was known as the Blowtorch Battalion because of the way that they would torch villages and kill all the inhabitants and so forth. That was sort of the Waffen-SS way of pursuing their objectives in war. Peiper was to lead, basically, he was the armoured spearhead of the whole thing. His Kampfgruppe, or battle group, which was extremely strong with tanks and half-tracks and so forth, was to punch its way through all the way to the Meuse and hopefully open up the route for the others to follow. But once again, although Peiper's advance was extremely rapid on the second day, it was pretty slowed on the first because some of the tanks ran into mines and others were held up, in fact, by the infantry in front of them. Mm-hmm. And Peiper was, of course, absolutely furious. But on the second day, he really broke through. But he started straight off at Honsveld, one village where they were massacring both American prisoners and Belgian civilians. Mm-hmm. And this pattern carried on through to Stavelo, again a massacre of prisoners and so forth. But the most famous massacre of all took place, it was called the Malmedy Massacre, but in fact it was just south of Malmedy at the crossroads at Bourniers, where a virtually unarmed artillery observation battalion ran into the SS vanguard and was basically shot up, and the soldiers were rounded up, about 135 of them rounded up, and then suddenly the SS started shooting, and altogether 84 of them were killed. Some had been wounded and then had a Kopfschuss, a neck shot, as the German army used to refer to it, through the back of the head, and they even shot a few civilians who tried to hide some of the American prisoners. Now, this caused such rage, as one might imagine, in the American army, when news got that within a matter of a couple of hours back to 1st Army headquarters, which was actually not very far away at Spa, and then it spread to Versailles, to Scheiff's headquarters with Meisenhower, and to Bradley at Luxembourg. And there was an immediate determination that revenge would be taken on the SS, but unfortunately, of course, that sort of spread to almost any German soldiers who were taken prisoner. Although many historians in the past, I'm afraid, have always been reluctant to face up to the fact of the killing of prisoners. I mean, in the First World War, it was far more common than has ever really been acknowledged. But one has to also understand the different reasons for it. There could be furious revenge. There could be often reasons like revenge for a friend, a buddy who'd been killed. In some cases also, I'm afraid, there was just, it was purely, if you like, administrative simplicity, because particularly armoured troops had no spare soldiers to send back as escort. So people in armoured troops often, and this was on both sides as well, would kill the prisoners straight away. What I found very alarming was, of course, that this was encouraged even from a very high level in on the United States Army. Whether that, to what degree that actually filtered down, it's very hard to tell. But one knows from the conversations of generals, both Bradley and of General Simpson of the 9th Army, who was thrilled that the 30th Division was fighting back in such a way that it was now being, the Germans were now referring to the 30th Division as Roosevelt's butchers. So there was a deliberate encouragement, I think, of this. And although the Germans had certainly started it, the Americans certainly didn't hang back in this process of shooting prisoners.
I wanted you to say something about Peiper's eventual fate, because I think it's, you know, it's an interesting illustration that these things don't end with the end of hostilities.
Well, no, the story carried on quite a way. First of all, Peiper and many of his men, I think about 74 of them or whatever, were tried for war crimes. A number of them were sentenced to death, including Peiper. This was commuted. And then, of course, in after 47, 48, when sort of West German administration was more or less set up, many of them started to be pardoned. Peiper, I think, stayed in prison, as far as I remember, it was about 11 years before he was released. And then, rather bizarrely, he went to decided to go and live in a sort of remote farmhouse in the French Alps, which you would have thought was a fairly unwise thing, considering his reputation and fame, or infamy, if you like. And once the French members of the old French resistance found that he was there, Piper's days were numbered, and apparently he actually said to a French journalist, saying that I will soon, in a typical sort of Wagnerian way almost, I will soon be joining my comrades in Valhalla. And sure enough, it wasn't long before his farmhouse, whether he was shot or not beforehand, we don't know, but whether his farmhouse was sort of set on fire deliberately, but certainly local members of the old resistance were after him.
But you say it wasn't long, this was in 1976.
Well, when I say it wasn't long, but this wasn't long after. Remember, sure. He'd spent 11 years in prison, and then it was some time before he moved to France.
But I like the irony of the fact of him being murdered by ex French resistance fighters virtually 30 years after the hostilities ended.
Yes, but you know, long memories.
Yeah. Just to finish off this part, then, we've talked repeatedly about why Hitler chose to attack through the Ardennes, about that, you know, he's choosing to do it when the weather was going to be bad because it meant that the Allies' air superiority wasn't an issue, the fact that fighting through forests or assembling through forests would hide the troop movement and the gathering. But of course it was that terrain and that time of year that really scuppered that lightning advance for the Germans as well, wasn't it?
Yes. The bad weather was wonderful as a shield, if you like, because lack of visibility meant air reconnaissance was pretty rare and patchy. And also very little air reconnaissance was carried out over the Ardennes Eiffel forest. So this is one of the reasons why the Americans were caught out. But on the other hand, of course, it was a double-edged sword because it meant that the ground was absolutely saturated at that time of the year. And what they had badly underestimated, which is very surprising for the Germans considering their experience in the Soviet Union, was, of course, that the mud meant that, A, a lot of the lorries, the supply trucks, would not be able to get through afterwards, especially after the tanks had churned up all the tracks. Because, I mean, in the Ardennes, there were hardly any real roads. Mm-hmm. There were very few metal roads. They were nearly always tracks, which actually could be churned into an absolute mud mire in no time at all. And this is one of the real elements which slowed them down. It also meant that their consumption of fuel was several times greater than what had been estimated. So although General Feldmarshal Keitel, had estimated their fuel requirements, the trouble was also that Allied bombing had prevented the fuel from getting across the Rhine. And the other thing, which was the American reaction. Now, as I say, Eisenhower, I think, was probably at his best in the first few days of the Ardennes of getting that quick reaction by not only bringing in reinforcements so rapidly. I mean, at one point, they actually brought in nearly 90,000 men in 24 hours. And I mean, only the American army with its huge quantity of trucks, but also its organisation, was capable of organising such a thing. But those trucks coming in, bringing the reinforcements, also took out the fuel supplies from vulnerable depots. So the whole idea that the Germans would be able to go punching on forwards as a result of capturing American fuel depots proved to be completely false.
This is Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Anthony Beaver about his book Ardennes 1944, Hitler's Last Gamble. And Anthony, I want to take a closer look at a couple more personalities from the German side. The first one particularly being to counterpoint Piper, who we talked about in the first half. And this is Oberst Friedrich August Haider, who, ended up leading Operation Stosser, which I'll ask you to tell us a little bit about. But let's talk about him first of all, because he's not a
not like Piper.
No, Hayter actually was an extremely intelligent man. I interviewed him, in fact, about the Battle of Crete. He was a great friend of Paddy Lee Firmer and George Weidenfeld in Vienna well before the war. And Hayter was actually a law professor, as well as being a colonel of the paratroopers. Mm. An extremely brave man, who was also actually morally brave too. It's very rare to find physical bravery and moral bravery going together, because of the way that he stood up to the SS and basically insulted the commander of the 17th SS Panzer Division. And they wanted to have him arrested and all the rest of it because of his basically anti-Nazi stance.
Mm-hmm. And his relations.
And his relations, indeed. I mean, you know, Hunter had to fill in a sort of formula, a response paper on sort of who he was related to, because at this particular point, after the July plot, Hitler was obsessed, not surprisingly, that the whole, not just of the general staff, but above all of the aristocracy, were against him. And to a large degree, it was true. I mean, they used to despise the Brown Band, as they used to refer to the Nazis, and so forth. And Hayter was certainly one of them. He was openly contemptuous, but sort of, you know, carried on to do his duty. And even though he was ordered to carry out this virtually suicidal mission with supposedly 2,000 paratroopers, in the end, only a small number actually ever reached the target, he was forced to do this drop well behind the lines to seize particular roads and crossroads to help the German advance of the 6th Panzer Army. But he'd been to see Sepp Dietrich, who was probably drunk, according to Hayter, and had no clue, really, how to handle things. I mean, it was well known that his chief of staff was overworked to the point of nervous collapse because Sepp Dietrich was such a useless commander. But anyway, Hayter was, in theory, under him, and had to do his bidding, which was to seize these two roads towards Eupen in the rear of the American lines and hold them until the breakthrough came. Well, the breakthrough never came. Many of his men were hurt in the parachute drop because they were thrown out of the and they jumped from the aircraft in wind speeds which were way above the legal or safety limit, and most of their weapons were lost in the descent. So I mean, it was an absolute disaster in that particular way. And Hayter was eventually had to surrender. I mean, he was in an extremely bad way. He was very ill and had probably broken his arm on the fall.
And the other person I wanted to bring in briefly, he's sort of related to one of the more famous incidents of this campaign. This is Otto Skorzeny, who he deserves a book of his own. He's such a character.
Well, Skorzeny is a character, yes, as a thug of the First Order. I mean, Skorzeny was very large and tall and had this terrifying Schlager scars from sort of duels at university across his face. He was an Austrian. I mean, Hayter described him as a total sort of, you know, thug and so forth, and so did others. He had basically been tasked by Hitler to go and rescue Mussolini from where he was being held in 1943 at the Gran Sasso up in the mountains. And actually, it was quite an easy operation for Skorzeny and his commandos, because basically the Carabinieri were holding Mussolini up there on the orders of the sort of temporary Italian government, were not prepared to fight back, and so that was fairly straightforward. But German army officers used to joke that Skorzeny had been given the Knight's Cross of the Iron Cross for having carried this out, and then they joked, and of course he'd have received a higher award if he'd taken him back afterwards, because they thought that Mussolini was the biggest disaster which had ever happened to the Axis. Anyway, in this particular case, Hitler summoned Skorzeny well before any of the generals knew about Operation Helpsnebel, about Autumn Mist, the attack in the Ardennes, to tell him to prepare forces of American-speaking troops to basically break through and capture key bridges and so forth to accelerate the advance. And in fact, only a small number
really were capable of speaking. Those really were Germans who'd returned from the United States at the beginning of the war, and so I would say knew some of the lingo. But I mean, the idea of training these guys so they had to hold their knife and fork in the same way as American soldiers, as if they're actually going to get into a canteen with them, and that they had to watch all of these American films so that they were taught how to tap their cigarettes on cigarette packets before they lit them, and details like that were all ludicrous, because none of them even got that far. Most of the Operation Greif, which was these jeeps with a few, with four American dressed soldiers in them, was actually a mistake straight off, because the Americans never put as many as four in a jeep. Three was the absolute maximum. So there they were, revealing themselves almost straight away as being slightly dubious before the Americans realised what was happening in that sense. The only effect, positive effect, if you like, of this whole operation was that one of those captured talked of a rumour that they were really trying to go and capture Eisenhower, they were going to go and kidnap Eisenhower. And this caused total chaos and panic on the Allied side, because it meant that sort of roadblocks were set up everywhere, which slowed things down, and Eisenhower in Versailles was in a sort of lockdown from the Counter Intelligence Corps because they were so paranoid about his security. So, I mean, apart from sort of a total over-the-top American reaction to the whole thing, it actually achieved very, very little. All those captured were executed for having tried to break through in Allied uniform. And, in fact, the tanks, which were camouflaged as American or Allied vehicles, as some of them were Shermans, which had been captured, others were German tanks sort of painted and disguised as Allied ones, they were then used in another attack later, but that they never served their purpose of actually causing any form of breakthrough.
I'm Dylan Evans. Go and read some great new journalism and explore the interview archive at littleatoms.com.
Let's move ourselves toward the conclusion of the campaign. And so there are key incidents, battles, the battle for Elsenborn Ridge and the siege at Bastogne, that I guess mainly sort of symbolise this idea that, you know, Hitler thought that the Americans would be easy, they would capitulate, they would fall back, and they didn't.
They didn't, and I think that, you know, there were one or two generals who could spot right at the beginning the right strategy, tactics, whatever, to adopt tactics, really. They knew that they had to hold the northern and the southern shoulders, i.e. either side of the breakthrough had to be strong. So the northern shoulder was the Elsenborn Ridge, which actually was extremely effective. It was an old Belgian army depot. And they brought in all of their artillery. They had altogether 23 artillery battalions up on the Elsenborn Ridge. So they were able to hammer the German rear, but also basically interfere with the whole of the supply line of the Germans coming through. And right in the south, they were able to hold the southern shoulder there without too much trouble. This was just sort of north of Luxembourg. But the key place, in a way, was, first of all, Saint-Vite, which was near the front, and they knew that this was sort of one of the road network centres of road networks. So they had to hold that to slow them down, which they managed to for a sort of heroic fight of about 5 days. And the other place, of course, was Bastogne. And this was where they sent one of their most immediate reserves. They had the two American parachute divisions, the 82nd and the 101st, in reserve near Reims in France at the camp of Mormelon. And the 101st was sent to Bastogne, and it got there just in time before the German panzer divisions broke through. And by holding Bastogne and forcing the Germans to take huge circuits around, they basically slowed down that advance very dramatically. Hitler, of course, as he'd shown before in the Soviet Union, when he was frustrated in achieving his breakthrough across the Meuse, then immediately sought a sort of what one might call an ersatz or a replacement objective. And so the Battle of Bastogne almost became, rather like the Battle of Stalingrad, the sort of replacement objective for the whole offensive. And it was never the plan at the beginning. And that's why it became such a sort of desperate battle.
And so at what point then does this offensive, at what point is it over? When does it sort of categorically fail?
The German generals, particularly Manteuffel, reckoned within 2 or 3 days that it had failed. I mean, they simply, because they had not achieved the momentum of advance, they knew that the Americans would be able to bring in reinforcements, and that would eventually block them at the Meuse, if not before. The actual, in terms of the actual advance, it was over on Christmas Day or the day after Christmas on the 26th of December. I mean, that was their furthest point, when the second Panzer Panzer Division got to within about 4 miles of the Meuse at Dinan and were counterattacked. They were actually stopped by British tanks. Though you won't find this in any American account, because Montgomery stirred up such resentment, I'm afraid, so the British contribution has been rather written out. I'm not trying to pretend that it was very large, but in fact, I think two things are slightly significant that American versions tend to wipe it out. Because Montgomery had realised that the defence of the Meuse was absolutely vital, so right from the start he'd moved the 30th Corps all the way round so as to be able to block the Meuse at those particular points, Dinan and others. And that was really the sort of high point of the whole thing. From then on, it was just going to be a slugging match. And the trouble was that the Americans, and this is where they were so angry with Montgomery, Montgomery actually was justified and very sensible in what he wanted to do, which was to allow the Germans to go on battering against Allied defences, because you could kill far more Germans that way for fewer losses on your own side. But the American generals, especially Patton, Collins and others, were desperate to have a conspicuous victory, and Bradley above all, to wipe out the humiliation of having been caught napping, because they knew, especially Bradley, had heard that there was might be a Senate investigation into the intelligence disaster, and so that's why Bradley was so desperate to have the bulge crushed as soon as possible.
I want to go on to talk about, you know, what, if anything, impact this campaign had on the rest of the war, the outcome. But just parking that for a second, you've raised Montgomery again. And although this is not directly necessarily related to Ardennes, it's more about the whole advance across France. But you mentioned the, you know, the idea of, you know, the Americans sort of writing the British out of accounts of, of this campaign. But what happened also basically removed any further influence of the British over the outcome of the war, didn't it?
It did, I'm afraid. Montgomery had, A, exasperated them quite often in his handling of the generals. I mean, when Montgomery arrived to take over command of the northern side of the Bulge, because Bradley was trapped down in Luxembourg and therefore couldn't exert command. And Bradley was horrified when he heard that Eisenhower had taken this decision, but it was the right decision in the circumstances. Also because Hodges, the commander of the 1st Army, US Army, was in a state of collapse at that particular point, sort of nervous collapse. But Montgomery did not make things better by arriving as one of his own staff officers of tribe, like Christ coming to cleanse the temple. And then he humiliated the generals. He then humiliated Bradley on Christmas Day. Bradley was offered, he claims, and it may well have been true, just an apple for Christmas dinner, having been sort of summoned to see Montgomery at his headquarters. All of this was totally unnecessary. And again, I'm afraid, then, when it came to early January, and the British press was egging on Montgomery in this way, again claiming, when it was announced that he had actually taken over command of the North, saying, now Montgomery must be made land forces commander for the whole of Europe, basically. And the American press was furious, and the American generals were furious, not surprisingly. And then Montgomery persuaded Churchill that he should be allowed to give a press conference in which he could praise Eisenhower and saying how much we should support him. And unfortunately, of course, Montgomery not only made his statement, but then couldn't resist getting carried away and basically boasting how he'd won the whole battle. And German propaganda very cleverly broadcast on BBC wavelengths another version which was even more extreme or whatever, which Americans heard and believed. And the effect was catastrophic because, A, Montgomery just simply was ignored from then on and cold-shouldered. It also meant that when it was a question of crossing the Rhine, Montgomery was basically pushed off to the side and was not allowed to go anywhere near the sort of the centre of the front at all. And Britain lost all influence in Allied councils. When there was the meeting on Malta, just before the Yalta Conference, everything that the British put forward was immediately vetoed by the Americans. And the Americans were in the driving seat, there's no doubt about it. I mean, Britain was losing its influence very rapidly, and I'm afraid it received the coup de grace from Montgomery's egotism.
So, yeah, so what did Hitler's decision to launch the Ardennes offensive ultimately achieve? What outcome did it have for the rest of the war?
Well, it certainly slowed down the Allied advance in the West, there's no doubt about that. But its most important effect was, of course, to sacrifice, for very little advantage, the bulk of his remaining armour. Now, as Guderian had wanted, you know, that if that had been transferred to the Eastern Front, the Soviet attack in mid-January into East Prussia, but particularly from the Vistula all the way to the River Oder, would not have been nearly so easy. Mm-hmm. Russian historians, of course, are not very keen on accepting this particular possibility. But it means certainly that the Americans could easily have got to Berlin first, mm-hmm. In that particular sense. In fact, the Americans could have got to Berlin first as things stood, mm-hmm. But Eisenhower vetoed the idea. He did not want to suffer casualties for something, for capturing areas which were eventually going to be handed over to the Soviets anyway afterwards.
Could things have been different, finally? So when Hitler was first proposing this campaign, some of his generals sort of said, okay, well, it's a terrible idea, but there's something we could do there. You know, there was a smaller solution.
Yes.
Could the outcome have been different?
I don't think the whole outcome of the war would have been very different at all. I mean, you know, whether the war would have gone on for a few more weeks or fewer weeks or whatever is impossible to tell. Mm-hmm. And I don't really like playing sort of counterfactual games in that particular way. I mean, one needs to pose the question, of course. I think, though, that the real effect, of course, was the way that it was much easier to destroy the Germans in the open.
Yeah.
When they were attacking, because obviously the attacker always loses more casualties in the end, than battering away at very effective German defensive positions along the Siegfried Line and elsewhere. And I mean, these were causing very, very heavy American and Allied casualties in the north as well. So the outcome, in fact, probably accelerated the end of the war on balance. But I don't think that one can say that it sort of changed anything in that way.
So I've been talking to Anthony Beaver. We've been talking about his book, Ardennes 1944, Hitler's Last Gamble. Anthony, thank you so much for coming in and telling me about it.
Not at all. Thank you, Neil.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
The show is supported by 89UP and hosted by Positive Internet. You can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
You can find old interviews, new journalism, and more on our relaunched website, littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.